Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Banks and the future of bill paying, what to do with spare chicken thighs, and Resolve, college just ain't worth it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, insuring more than 80 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them on newsstands, iPhone, and iPad, and at The Economist Online.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on a Wednesday, everybody. It's the 25th of May today. And, you know, we can talk all we want about consumer spending and retail sales and corporate profits, but the whole thing does kind of come crashing down without a way to get the money from one place to another. There's cash, which is usually great, electronic wire transfers for big amounts. There's PayPal for online retail, and a development today that might well be the future of spending, another stab at what's often called the digital wallet. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and JP Morgan Chase are making a joint play to let customers send money to each other with just an email address or a cell phone number. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The new service allows customers, armed with nothing more than a smartphone, to log into their checking account, enter a cell phone number or email address, and transfer money instantly. You can only use it to send money to another person, like sending birthday money or answering that time-honored college student plea. Wells Fargo's Mike Kennedy says people transfer about $865 billion to each other every year.
The primary way that people are doing that is old-fashioned cash and check. And they've come to us and said, we want to be able to do electronic.
Banks are under a lot of pressure to go mobile. They're already losing business to online payment sites like PayPal, and credit cards will soon have to contend with cell phone payment options from companies like Google. Ron Shevlin is a banking products analyst with the Aite Group.
Offering these mobile capabilities is a way to continue to stay connected with the customer base, give them more convenience for payments. And it also produces an incredible data stream,
which banks can use to sell those customers more products. Andrew Davidson with Mintel Compromedia says this is also the final front in the bank's war on cash.
The real big piece of business for the banks is still to get people to shift their habits from using cash to using cards and electronic forms of payment.
Banks cut check processing costs and can charge new fees. The service is only in Arizona now, where it's free. It will roll out nationally over the next year, and the banks will decide how much to charge. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I saw gas for $3.99 around the corner from my house the other day. In other words, not $4 a gallon. And even though pump prices are sliding backward slowly, car buyers are no doubt a bit more curious about miles per gallon now than they were a year or so ago. Today, the feds unveiled what they consider a spiffed-up fuel economy sticker that's going to go on new cars, starting with the 2013 model year. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Administration officials didn't waste time trying to gain some political mileage off the new window stickers. Here's how Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood introduced them today.
We understand that gasoline prices are killing family budgets, and we're doing everything we can to help family budgets.
LaHood says the new labels not only give the familiar miles per gallon, they also give a combined fuel economy and greenhouse gas rating on a scale of 1 to 10, along with a smog rating, along with savings in fuel costs over 5 years compared to the average new car, and special labels for hybrids and electric vehicles that include driving range and charge times. Ed Lapham is executive editor at Automotive News.
Frankly, if you look at this label, it's very difficult to tell what the heck it means.
Which benefits car makers, claims Dan Becker at the Safe Climate Campaign. He preferred an earlier draft of the label that assigned a simple letter grade for fuel economy, a system that would have probably doled out B's and C's to the majority of vehicles on the road right now.
The auto industry just came down like a ton of bricks and lobbied the administration to death on it. And so the administration caved to their pressure, which is very disappointing.
Automakers called letter grades too simplistic. Consumers Union agreed and today praised the more complex labels as clear and science-based. At least all the science you can reasonably fit on a window sticker. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Check out the stickers for yourself. There are some pictures on our website. It's marketplace.org. On now to chicken, dark meat specifically. It's generally a tough sell here in the United States, and those thighs and drumsticks used to get shipped overseas to Russia and China mostly. Exports are down, though, so the poultry industry is trying to figure out how to market dark meat to picky American eaters. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Why aren't Americans all that into thighs and drumsticks? Marcy Pelshaw from the Monell Chemical Science Center says there are a couple of reasons.
In our culture, until very recently, white food was more pure, was more upper class than brown food.
Seriously, that's a real thing. Pelshaw says there's something else. Legs and thighs come with bones and skin.
And did look like part of an animal. And many people find that to be disgusting.
If you ask people, what do you like, white meat or dark meat, there's about a 2-to-1 preference for white meat.
Richard Lobb is with the National Chicken Council. The poultry math just doesn't add up. That's too many extra legs. American warehouses are filling up with dark meat. And chicken giant Tyson sees an opportunity marketing the cheaper cuts. Craig Bacon is a Tyson VP.
Just becomes, you know, a strategy that works well for consumers that are looking for value, and they're trying to feed their family with, you know, maybe fewer dollars to spend.
Bacon says Tyson is also considering turning dark meat into other foods, like chicken sausage and chicken burgers, food without all those disgusting bones. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Traders on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange paused spontaneously this morning for a moment of silence in memory of CNBC anchor Mark Haynes. He died unexpectedly overnight. When things resumed, a slow but steady climb on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm reliably told by a Russian-speaking colleague here at Marketplace World Headquarters that IPO in Russian is pronounced roughly E-P-O. We're dabbling in the bilingual today to set up a story on the Russian internet search company Yandex, which went public yesterday to much fanfare. From Moscow, Peter Van Dyke has more.
The company, often called Russia's Google, is hot among investors. The rocketing share price is one sign of that. Another is the fact that in yesterday's IPO, demand for shares was 17 times greater than the number on offer. Annelies van den Belt is the CEO of Soup Media, a Russian internet publisher.
Yandex does many things and they almost do all of them very well.
Maybe that's why Yandex is used for some 63% of searches on the web in Russia, against about 20% for Google. Analysts say Yandex's setup handles the grammatical complexities of Russian better than Google.
They had a head start in terms of technology, but also in terms of opening up the market, and they've done really well to monetize that.
Yandex is making good money from advertising, the source of almost all the $445 million it brought in last year. The company's been turning a profit since 2003. Bruce Bauer, a partner at Verno Capital in Moscow, says the company's management is another asset. People like co-founders Arkady Volosh and Ilya Segalovich.
The management team is a bunch of scientists, engineers who founded the company, and they're very dedicated to the company. They're not doing an IPO to buy yachts and ride around on the Mediterranean. In many cases, Yandex has been more innovative than Google in the local market.
Yandex has plans to expand beyond Russia. In the wider world, it may find Google a tougher competitor. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
We mentioned PayPal up at the top of the broadcast, and we're going to reference it again here. Peter Thiel was one of the co-founders of the bill-paying site. That makes him a billionaire and something of an iconoclast. Thiel thinks higher education in this country is overpriced and overvalued. I'm telling you this because, to prove his point, his foundation is paying 24 of our best young students $100,000 apiece not to go to college for 2 years and to start businesses instead. The experiment, not to mention the soaring cost of a college degree, is creating a lot of debate in education circles and among two of our reporters as well. Amy Scott is our education correspondent. Steve Hand covers technology for us from Silicon Valley, land of the superstar college dropout. So, guess who's on which side?
Most of the fellows are pretty excited about this. I talked to John Burnham. He's 18, and he's skipping his own high school graduation to get started. This summer, he's interning at MoonX, which is a private space exploration company.
There's an incredible amount for me to learn, and I'm swimming in an ocean of information that's just, I feel like I'm a kid in a candy store.
Burnham's sketching out a business plan to mine rare minerals from asteroids in the moon.
Wait, what?
And fly them back to Earth.
Steve, this sounds crazy. This guy really wants to drop out of college to mine the moon?
Basically, yeah. And, you know, it might not work, but I think Thiel just wants to show that bright, motivated kids like Burnham don't have to go to college. They can innovate or learn in other ways.
Sure, if someone pays you $100,000 not to go to college, but what happens to Space Boy when the money runs out and he's left without a college degree? You know, Thiel isn't the only one worried about innovation in the economy. I called Judy Estrin. She's a tech entrepreneur herself and just wrote the book Closing the Innovation Gap. She says the Mark Zuckerbergs or Steve Jobs of the world are one in a million.
It's like saying, I'm going to drop out and become a rock star. And how many musicians do you know that don't ever make it to be a rock star?
Plenty.
Yeah, but there might be a rock star or two in this bunch. These kids are incredible. And, you know, the ones I've talked to have said if this doesn't work out in a year or two, they can always just go back to college.
Right, but Thiel wants a lot of people to do this. That's the whole point. He's egging on this growing chorus of people wondering whether college is really worth the money.
Yeah.
And for most people, it is. I mean, the typical person who just finished high school makes about $20,000 less a year than someone who went to college and is twice as likely to be unemployed.
But that's just because employers are fixated on college degrees.
Well, they want college-educated workers. I mean, listen to this guy. His name is Mike McPherson. He's an economist and the former president of McAllister College.
I think there is really what I would call the strongest consensus among economists that you can find on any subject that college pays.
But it doesn't pay for everyone. You know, Amy, you probably know these numbers better than I do. Right now, there's $1 trillion in student debt out there. And students whose educations don't pay off for them, they can't just walk away or declare bankruptcy to get out from under it. And the costs of college have gone up tenfold since the 80s.
Yeah, but you're talking about the sticker price of college, which most people don't actually pay. Financial aid has been rising at the same time.
Still, something like one-third of all students who start a four-year college don't get a degree after 6 years. You know, I don't think college pays for them. This is still supposed to be the ticket to the American dream for everyone. You know, I think Thiel wants everyone to begin to question that. Here, you know, I'll let him speak for himself.
We no longer believe in housing. We no longer believe in technology. We have faith in very few institutions, but probably education is one thing where you still have an almost manic or desperate belief that this is the ticket to the future and that you should get an education no matter what the price. And that makes it very dangerous.
Okay, there's no question that debt is a huge problem, especially if you don't get a job right away or a good paying one. But, you know, Steve, there are lots of non-economic reasons to go to college.
Yeah, like keggers.
Well, like learning or, you know, college grads report being happier. They're more satisfied with their jobs. They're more likely to vote. And, you know, it may not be fair, but the truth is, in many ways, higher education is a ticket to success in our society.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be the only ticket, and it definitely shouldn't be this expensive.
Pretty good debate, Steve. You learned that at Wesleyan. And by the way, Peter Thiel went to Stanford.
Yeah, true.
Amy Scott, Steve Hand, you can weigh in online, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, smoke 'em if you got 'em.
The filters always break, and like if you don't put enough in, it's not packed enough. It's just, I don't know, it's just a pain.
Roll your own cigarettes are back, but first, let's do the numbers. As oil goes, so go the markets. A barrel of crude topped $100 today, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average tacked on 38 points, nearly a third of 1%, closed to 12,394. The NASDAQ rose 15 points, more than a half percent, ended at 2761. The S&P 500 added 4 points, also about a third percent, finished at 1320. No surprise, shares of the major oil companies all gushed higher. Chevron led the pack. It had a 1% increase today. Another winner, Martha Stewart Living OmniMedia. Shares in the company that Domesticity built tidied up 24% on news that it could soon be for sale. Things looked a little threadbare over at Polo Ralph Lauren, or Ralph Lauren. I can never ever get it right. The purveyor of high-end fashions unraveled 11% today after it posted a drop in quarterly profits. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained local agents committed to small business success. More at 1-866-200-4BIZ. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases its second estimate gross domestic product report for the first quarter. A House subcommittee on space and aeronautics discusses NASA's commercial cargo providers. Are they ready to supply the space station in the post-shuttle era? And she recently portrayed Queen Elizabeth in The King's Speech. Actress Helena Bonham Carter turns 45. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama delivered a 35-minute speech to the British Parliament today about the Euro-American partnership as a force for good in the world. The word debt, perhaps not surprisingly, was uttered exactly once, even as the European Union scrambles to contain its mounting financial crisis. Commentator David Frum says the European debt story has some familiar American themes.
On Monday, European financial markets were rocked by new fears for the future of the euro currency. The euro dropped to a 2-month low against the dollar. Borrowing costs are spiking not only for Greece, but also for Portugal, Ireland, and Spain. The Italian stock market dropped 3.3% in a day. You can see why markets are frightened. The countries of Southern Europe have borrowed enormous amounts in euros. They must either cut spending or raise taxes to pay that debt in today's tougher economic environment. But voters erupt in protests when governments take steps to balance their budgets. The TV cameras focus on the riots in Athens, but the real news is delivered at the ballot box. On Sunday, Spanish voters hammered the governing Socialist Party in local elections. Politicians may believe in the euro. They may want to pay their debts. But above all else, they want to preserve their hold on office. Default beckons as the easiest way out. But it's not just Europe, and it's not just about the euro. Here in the United States, default talk is gathering too. The problem is not that the United States cannot pay its debts. Even now, despite all the apocalyptic talk, the debt-to-GDP ratio remains below the peak levels of the Truman administration. The problem is that the United States political system cannot produce agreement on the measures necessary to service the debt and then gradually reduce it. That's why the debt limit was not raised this month, and why the U.S. Treasury is now scrambling to tap employee pension funds to pay bills. There are plenty of obvious budget cuts and revenue raisers at hand to reduce the U.S. deficit over the medium term. It's not a matter of can't, it's a matter of won't. It's common in U.S. politics to hear comparisons to Greece, if we don't do X or if we don't do Y. It's a fair comparison, but only if you understand that what we share in common with Greece is not an inability to borrow, it is an inability to govern.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Coming up next week in this time slot, Robert Reich is back. Your views, yeah, whenever works for you. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. It's a Wednesday, so what say we check the inbox?
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We did a story the other day about social impact bonds, government spending that's more results-based than government spending tends to be. That is, if a program doesn't work, investors don't get paid. Beth McConnell from Philadelphia says profit loss is a lousy way to think about human beings.
What happens if a program aimed at reducing prisoner recidivism fails to perform because the prisoners have no jobs to go to despite job training, or can't get hired because of racism or stigma associated with being an ex-con? Do we stop doing our best to offer ex-cons a chance at a decent life because investors get no return?
We talked about boutique butchers last week and the snout-to-tail movement, chefs serving up all the parts of a given animal. We said feeding animals to fatten them up to feed people isn't necessarily the most resource-efficient thing to do, which got an email from Barbara Corson, a veterinarian in Dauphin, Pennsylvania. She raises cows and chickens at home, and she wrote to defend the barnyard.
In many places on Earth, plants for human consumption can't be grown without heavy inputs of energy in the form of petroleum for plowing, cultivating, fertilizing, and irrigating. Consider the alternative. A cow or sheep on pasture is essentially solar-powered. Domestic animals also contribute other necessities besides food, including leather, manure for fertilizer, and draft power.
Finally, Henry Paulson. I talked to director Curtis Hanson Monday about his HBO movie about the financial crisis, Too Big to Fail, and I said at one point as we were talking that you wind up feeling sorry for the former Treasury Secretary and all the rest of them. I also said we'd get some letters about that, and I was right. Here's Sam Mantke from Houston, Texas.
Which one of these awful characters is penniless and on the street? Which one of them no longer lives in a million-dollar mansion? How many of the CEOs depicted in this movie lost their jobs like 14 million Americans, save Lehman Brothers' Richard Fuld?
So there you go. We want to hear from you. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Federal excise tax on a pack of cigarettes in this country is a dollar and a penny, a dollar one. State and city taxes vary, but they're often higher, and in the end it all adds up. In New York City, for instance, a pack of smokes will set you back $11. So the roll-your-own movement is gathering some steam, with a twist. Aaron Toner reports now from WUWM in Milwaukee.
Brianna Wolfel has dyed pink hair, carries a purse with a big peace sign, and she rolls cigarettes at home because she feels it's a more natural way to smoke. But Wolfel calls the process a horrible pain.
The filters always break, and like if you don't put enough in, it's not packed enough. It's just a pain.
So Wolfel decided to check out a new shop near Milwaukee called Let's Roll Tobacco.
So what we do is you can kind of just take these tongs here.
It's sort of like those paint-your-own pottery shops. Here, customers use sophisticated machines to make their own cigarettes.
Since you have a blend of more than two tobaccos here, you can just put it in this bucket and give it a good shake. So
Wolfel chooses a bold tobacco blend and menthol-flavored filters and carries both over to a rolling machine the size of a vending machine. Store manager Jack Vlasic instructs Wolfel to gently pour the tobacco into the machine's hopper, insert the filters, and push start. One at a time, cigarettes pop out of a chute near the base of the machine and land in a plastic bin.
I like it a lot. It's a lot faster.
The machine rolls nearly 200 cigarettes, or the equivalent of a carton, in just 8 minutes. It costs just under $30. At a gas station down the road, a carton of Marlboro Lights sells for $74. Jack Vlasic says the store's been open just 2 months and business is booming.
Most of the customers, 99% of them, very, very happy with what they're getting. They're saving money, they're saving time.
Hundreds of roll-your-own shops like this have opened around the country. They're able to offer cheaper cigarettes because they use pipe tobacco, which is taxed at around $3 a pound compared to $25 for rolling tobacco. The stores are very careful to appear as retailers. Employees instruct customers during the process, but don't touch any of the equipment. They also call their products smokes, not cigarettes. But regulators say what looks like a cigarette is a cigarette.
They're doing this little dance, you know, that is like a concerted search for loopholes.
David Rienzo is an assistant attorney general in New Hampshire. He's sued several roll-your-own shops, alleging they're actually cigarette manufacturers and therefore subject to all cigarette laws and taxes.
They make a profit off of the cigarettes that are being made, and they make a profit off the fact that the cigarettes are being manufactured in their store. To us, that meant that they were in the business of manufacturing cigarettes.
The federal government is also weighing in. The Treasury Department says the shops should be taxed as cigarette manufacturers, but that ruling is tied up in court. Phil Accordino is one of the parties that challenged the ruling. He owns the company that makes the big rolling machines. Accordino says his product only slightly improves upon the devices people use at home legally to roll their own cigarettes.
Our machine will make, at best, about 4 cartons in an hour. A true cigarette manufacturing machine will make upwards of 20,000 cigarettes a minute. You cannot confuse the two.
Accordino says there are several do-it-yourself precedents, like stores that let customers brew their own beer on premises. The federal government says those stores are legal and exempt from excise taxes if store employees do not assist in the production. In Milwaukee, I'm Aaron Toner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, somebody has finally bought that tanker ship full of oil from the Libyan rebels, the one that was shipped back in April. And get this, it was us. The U.S. refiner Tesoro said today it's sending the million or so barrels of crude with a street value of $100 million at today's close to its plant in Hawaii. The company spokesman told Reuters the sale was done in strict accordance with government sanctions against Muammar Gaddafi. And that's where we leave it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow tacked on 38 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, more than a half percent. The S&P 500 added 4 points, also around a third of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, how the watchdogs failed to spot the financial crisis.
The regulators are so close to the entities they are charged with overseeing that they don't want to be an adversary.
Yeah, can't wait to hear that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for it tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.